angle, the single visible tusk rising high, the eye socket black as mystery. The shiver came again, and she hunched her shoulders. Easy to feel that it might at any moment wrench itself free of the clay and turn that massive head toward them, empty-eyed, clods of dirt raining from tusks and bony shoulders as it shook itself and began to walk, the ground vibrating as long toes struck and sank in the muddy soil.
"That's what it's called. Mammoth? Aye, well, it is very big."
Ian's voice dispelled the illusion of incipient movement, and she was able finally to take her eyes off it, though she felt she must glance back every second or so to be sure it was still there. "The Latin name is Mammuthus," she said, clearing her throat. "There's a complete skeleton in a museum in New York. I've seen it often, and I've seen pictures of them in books." She glanced back at the creature in the bank.
"A museum? So it's not a thing you've got where..."
"When?" He stumbled a bit.
"Where do you come from? Not alive, then, I mean."
He seemed rather disappointed. She wanted to laugh at the picture of mammoths roaming Boston Common or wallowing on the bank of the Cambridge River. In fact, she had a moment's pang of disappointment that they hadn't been there. It would have been so wonderful to see them. "No," she said regretfully. "They all died thousands and thousands of years ago when the ice came."
"Ice?"
Ian was glancing back and forth between her and the mammoth, as though afraid one or the other might do something untoward. "The Ice Age. The world got colder and sheets of ice spread down from the north. A lot of animals went extinct. I mean, they couldn't find food and all died." Ian was pale with excitement.
"Aye, I've heard such stories."
"You have?" She was surprised at that.
"Aye. But you see, it's real."
He swung his head to look at the mammoth's bones once more.
"An animal, aye? Like a bear or a possum?"
"Yes," she said, puzzled by his attitude, which seemed to alternate between eagerness and dismay.
"Bigger, but yes.
What else would it be?"
"Ah," he said, and took a deep breath. "Well, do you see, that's what I needed you to tell me, cuz. See, the Ganyangahaga, they have stories of things, animals that are really spirits. And if ever I saw a thing that might be a spirit..."
He was still looking at the skeleton, as though it might walk out of the earth, and she saw a slight shiver pass through him. She couldn't prevent a similar shiver looking at the massive creature. It towered above them, grim and awful, and only her knowledge of what it was kept her from wanting to cower and run. "It's real," she repeated, as much to reassure herself as him. "And it's dead. Really dead."
"How do you know these things?" he asked, intently curious. "It's old, you see. You'd be much further away from... that."
He jerked his chin at the giant skeleton. "In your own time than we are now. How can you ken more about it than folk do now?" She shook her head, smiling a little, and helpless to explain.
"When did you find this, Ian?"
"Last month. I came up the gorge," he gestured with his chin, "and there it was. I near beshit myself."
"I can imagine," she said, stifling an urge to laugh.
"Aye," he said, not noticing her amusement in his desire to explain. "I should have been sure that it was Rawenyu, a spirit, a god, see for the dog."
Rollo had climbed out of the stream, and having shaken the water from his fur, was squirming on his back in a patch of crushed turtle head, tail wagging in pleasure, and clearly oblivious to the silent giant in the cliff above.
"What do you mean, that Rollo wasn't afraid of it?"
Ian nodded.
"Aye. He didn't behave as though there were anything there at all. And yet..."
He hesitated, darting a glance at her.
"Sometimes, in the woods, he sees things. Things I canna see, ken?"
"I can," she said,
a ripple of unease returning.
Dogs do see things.
She remembered her own dogs, in particular Smokey, the big Newfoundland, who would sometimes in the evening suddenly raise his head, listening, hackles rising as his eyes followed something that passed through the room and disappeared. He nodded, relieved that she knew what he was talking about.
They do. I ran when I saw that.
He nodded at the cliff and ducked behind a tree.
But the dog went on about his business, paying it no mind. And so I thought, well, maybe it's no what I think, after all.
And what did you think? She asked.
A rawenio, you said.
As the excitement of seeing the mammoth began to recede, she remembered what they were theoretically doing here.
Ian, you said what you wanted to show me had to do with your wife. Is this...
She gestured toward the cliff, brows raised. He didn't answer directly, but tilted his head back, studying the jut of the giant tusks.
I heard stories now and then. Among the Mohawk, I mean. They'd speak of strange things that someone found hunting. Spirits trapped in the rock and how they came to be there. Evil things for the most part. And I thought to myself, if that should be what this is.
He broke off and turned to her, serious and intent.
I needed you to tell me, aye, whether that's what it is or no. Because if it was, then perhaps what I've been thinking is wrong.
It's not, she assured him. But what on earth have you been thinking?
About God, he said. Surprising her again.
He licked his lips, unsure how to go on.
Yetsa'a, the child. I didn't have her christened, he said. I couldna. Or perhaps I could. You can do it yourself, Ken, if there's no priest. But I hadna the courage to try. I never saw her. They'd wrapped her already. They wouldna have liked it if I'd tried to...
His voice died away. Yetsa'a, she said softly.
Was that your daughter's name?
He shook his head, his mouth twisting wryly.
It only means wee girl. The Ganyangahaga dinna give a name to a child when it's born. Not until later, if...
His voice trailed off, and he cleared his throat.
If it lives, they wouldna think of naming a child unborn.
But you did, she asked gently. He raised his head and took a breath that had a damp sound to it, like wet bandages pulled from a fresh wound.
Isabel, he said.
And she knew it was the first, perhaps would be the only time he'd spoken it aloud.
Had it been a son, I would have called him Jimmy.
He glanced at her with the shadow of a smile.
Only in my head, Ken.
He let out all his breath then with a sigh, and put his face down upon his knees, back hunched.
"What I'm thinking," he said after a moment, his voice much too controlled, "is this. Was it me?"
"Ian, you mean your fault that the baby died? How could it be?"
"I left," he said simply, straightening up, "turned away, stopped being a Christian, being Scots. They took me to the stream, scrubbed me with sand to take away the white blood. They gave me my name, Wolf's brother, and said I was Mohawk. But I wasna, not really."
He sighed deeply again, and she put a hand on his back, feeling the bumps of his backbone press through the leather of his shirt.
He didn't eat nearly enough, she thought. "But I wasna what I had been either," he went on, sounding almost matter-of-fact. "I tried to be what they wanted, Ken. So I left off praying to God, or the Virgin Mother, or St. Bride. I listened to what Emily said, when she'd tell me about her gods, the spirits that dwell in the trees and all. And when I went to the sweat lodge with the men, or sat by the hearth and heard their stories, they seemed as real to me as Christ and his saints ever had."
He turned his head and looked up at her suddenly, half bewildered, half defiant.
I am the Lord thy God, he said. Thou shalt have no gods before me.
But I did, no?
That's mortal sin, is it not?
She wanted to say no, of course not, or to protest weakly that she wasn't a priest. How could she say? But neither of those would do. He wasn't looking for easy reassurance, and a weak-minded abnegation of responsibility wouldn't serve him. She took a deep breath and blew it out. It had been a good many years since she'd been taught the Baltimore Catechism, but it wasn't the sort of thing you forget. The conditions of mortal sin are these, she said, reciting the words precisely from memory. First, that the action be grievously wrong. Second, that you know the action is wrong. And thirdly, that you give full consent to it. He was watching her intently.
Well, it was wrong. And I suppose I kent that.
Aye, I did ken that. Especially...
His face darkened further, and she wondered what he was recalling.
But how could I serve a God who would take a child for a father's sins?
Without waiting for an answer, he glanced toward the cliff face where the remains of the mammoth lay frozen in time.
Or was it them? Was it not my God at all, but the Iroquois spirits? Did they ken there wasn't a really Mohawk? That I held back a part of myself from them?
He looked back at her, dead serious.
Gods are jealous, are they, no?
Ian.
She swallowed, helpless, but she had to say something.
What you did, or didn't do, that wasn't wrong, Ian, she said firmly. Your daughter, she was half Mohawk. It wasn't wrong to let her be buried according to her mother's ways. Your wife, Emily, she would have been terribly upset, wouldn't she, if you'd insisted on baptizing the baby?
Aye, maybe, but...
He closed his eyes, hands clenched hard into fists on his thighs.
Where is she, then? He whispered,
and she could see tears trembling on his lashes.
The others, they were never born. God will have them in his hand. But we, Ishabel, she'll not be in heaven, will she? I cannot bear the thought that she might be lost somewhere, wandering.
Ian,
I hear her greeting in the night.
His breath was coming in deep sobbing gasps.
I canna help. I canna find her.
Ian.
The tears were running down her own cheeks. She gripped his wrists fiercely, squeezed as hard as she could.
Ian, listen to me.
He drew a deep, trembling breath, head bent. Then he nodded very slightly. She rose onto her knees and gathered him tight against her, his head cradled on her breasts. Her cheek pressed against the top of his head, his hair warm and springy against her mouth.
"Listen to me," she said softly. "I had another father, the man who raised me. He's dead now."
For a long time now, the sense of desolation at his loss had been muted, softened by new love, distracted by new obligations. Now it swept over her, newly fresh and sharp as a stab wound in its agony.
I know he's in heaven.
Was he?
Could he be dead and in heaven, if not yet born? And yet he was dead to her, and surely heaven took no heed of time.
She lifted her face toward the cliff, but spoke to neither bones nor God.
Daddy, she said, and her voice broke on the word, but she held her cousin hard. Daddy, I need you.
Her voice sounded small and pathetically unsure, but there was no other help to be had.
I need you to find Ian's little girl, she said, as firmly as she could, trying to summon her father's face, to see him there among the shifting leaves at the cliff top.
Find her, please. Hold her in your arms, and make sure that she's safe. Please take care of her.
She stopped, feeling obscurely that she should say something else, something more ceremonious. Make the sign of the cross? Say, Amen?
"Thank you, Daddy," she said softly,
and cried as though her father were newly dead, and she bereft, orphaned, lost, and crying in the night. Ian's arms were wrapped around her, and they clung tight together, squeezing hard, the warmth of the late sun heavy on their heads. She stood still within his arms when she stopped crying, her head resting on his shoulder. He patted her back very gently, but didn't push her away.
"Thank you," he whispered in her ear. "Are you all right, Brianna?"
"Uh-huh." She straightened and stood away from him, swaying a little, as though she were drunk. She felt drunk, too, her bones gone soft and malleable, everything around her faintly out of focus, save for certain things that caught her eye. A brilliant patch of pink lady slipper, a stone fallen from the cliff face, its surface streaked red with iron. Rollo, almost sitting on Ian's foot, big head pressed anxiously against his master's thigh.
"Are you all right, Ian?" she asked.
"I will be."
His hand sought Rollo's head and gave the pointed ears a cursory rub of reassurance.
"Maybe. Just...
what?
Are you sure, Brianna?"
She knew what he was asking. It was a question of faith. She drew herself up to her full height, wiping her nose on her sleeve. "I'm a Roman Catholic, and I believe in vitamins," she declared stoutly. "And I knew my father. Of course I'm sure." He took a deep, sighing breath, and his shoulders slumped as he let it out. He nodded then, and the lines of his face relaxed a little. She left him sitting on a rock and made her way down to the stream to splash cold water on her face. The shadow of the cliff fell across the creek, and the air was cold with the scent of earth and pine trees. In spite of the chill, she remained there for a while, on her knees. She could still hear the voices murmuring in trees and water, but paid no attention to them. Whoever they were no threat to her or hers, and not at odds with the presence that she felt so strongly nearby.
"I love you, Daddy," she whispered, closing her eyes, and felt at peace.
"Ian must be better too," she thought, when she made her way at length back through the rocks to where he sat. Rollo had left him to investigate a promising hole at the foot of a tree, and she knew the dog wouldn't have left Ian had he considered his master to be in distress. She was about to ask him whether their business here was complete when he stood up, and she saw that it wasn't.
"Why I brought you here," he said abruptly. "I wanted to know about that." He nodded at the mammoth. "But I meant to ask you a question. Advice-like."
"Advice? Ian, I can't give you any advice. How can I tell you what to do?"
"I think you're maybe the only one who can," he said with a lopsided smile. "You're my family. You're a woman. And you care for me. Yet you care more even than Uncle Jamie, perhaps, because of who or what."
His mouth twisted a little.
"You are?"
"I don't know more," she said, and looked up at the bones in the rock. "Only different things."
"Aye," he said,
and took a deep breath.
"Brianna," he said, very softly, "we're no wed. We never shall be."
He looked away for an instant, then back.
"But if we had been married, I should have loved you and cared for you so well as I could. I trust you, that you'd have done the same by me. Am I right?"
"Oh, Ian."
Her voice was still thick, raspy with grief. The words came out in a whisper. She touched his face, cool-skinned and bony, and traced the line of tattooed dots with a thumb.
"I love you now."
"Aye, well," he said, still softly. "I ken that."
He lifted a hand and put it over her own, big and hard. He pressed her palm against his cheek for a moment. Then his fingers closed over hers, and he brought their linked hands down
but didn't let go.
"So tell me," he said, his eyes not leaving hers, "if you love me, tell me what I shall do. Shall I go back?"
"Back?" she repeated, searching his face. "Back to the Mohawk, you mean?" He nodded.
"Back to Emily. She loved me," he said quietly. "I ken that. Did I do wrong to let the old woman send me away? Ought I to go back? Maybe fight for her if I had to. Perhaps see if she would come away with me, back to the ridge."
"Oh, Ian." She felt the same sense of helplessness as before, though this time it came without the burden of her own grief. But who was she to tell him anything? How could she be responsible for making that decision for him? For saying to him, "Stay or go"? His eyes stayed steady on her face, though, and it came over her. She was his family. And so the responsibility lay in her hands, whether she felt adequate to it or not. Her chest felt tight, as though she might burst if she took a deep breath. She took it anyway.
"Stay," she said.
He stood looking into her eyes for a long time, his own deep hazel, gold-flecked and serious.
"You could fight him, ach," she fumbled for the syllables of the Mohawk name, "Sun Elk.
But you can't fight her. If she's made up her mind that she doesn't want to be with you anymore, Ian, you can't change it." He blinked, dark lashes cutting off his gaze, and kept his eyes closed, whether in acknowledgement or denial of what she'd said, she didn't know.
"But it's more than that," she said, her voice growing firmer. "It isn't only her or him, is it?"
"No," he said. His voice sounded distant, almost uncaring, but she knew it wasn't that.
"It's them," she said more softly. "All the mothers, the grandmothers, the women, the children. Clan and family and tribe and nation. Custom, spirit, tradition. The strands that wrapped works with her hands and held her to the earth, secure. And above all, children, those loud small voices that drowned the voices of the wood and kept a soul from wandering through the night. No one knew the strength of such bonds better than one who had walked the earth without them, outcast and alone. She had, and he had, and they both knew the truth."
"It's them," he echoed softly, and opened his eyes. They were dark with loss, the colour of shadows in the deepest wood.
"And them." He turned his head to look upward into the trees beyond the creek, above the bones of the mammoth that lay trapped in the earth, stripped to the sky, and mute to all prayer.
He turned back, raised a hand, and touched her cheek.
"I'll stay then."
They camped for the night on the far side of the beaver pond. The litter of wood chips and debarked saplings made good kindling for their fire. There was little to eat, no more than a hatful of bitter fox grapes and the heel of bread, so hard by now that it had to be dunked in water to chew. It didn't matter. Neither one of them was hungry, and Rollo had disappeared to hunt for himself. They sat silently, watching the fire die down. There was no need to keep it going. The night wasn't cold, and they wouldn't linger in the morning. Home was too near. At last, Ian stirred a bit, and Brianna glanced at him.
"What was your father's name?" he asked,
very formally. Franklin. Franklin Wolverton Randall."
"An Englishman, then?"
"Very," she said, smiling in spite of herself. He nodded, murmuring, "Franklin Wolverton Randall," to himself, as though to commit it to memory, then looked at her seriously.
"If ever I find myself in a church again, then I shall light a candle to his memory." I expect he'd like that. He nodded and leaned back, back braced against a longleaf pine. The ground nearby was littered with the cones. He picked up a handful and tossed them, one by one, into the fire. "What about Lizzie?" she asked, after a little while. "She's always been fond of you." To put it mildly, Lizzie had wilted and pined for weeks when he had been lost to the Iroquois. "And now that she's not marrying Manfred." He tilted back his head, eyes closed, and rested it against the trunk of the pine.
"I've thought of it," he admitted.
"But?"
"Aye, but."
He opened his eyes and gave her a wry look.
"I'd ken where I was if I woke beside her. But where I'd be is in bed wi' my wee sister. I think I'm maybe not so desperate as that." "Yet," he added, as an obvious afterthought.
Chapter 71 Black Pudding. I was in the middle of a black pudding when Ronnie Sinclair appeared in the yard, carrying two small whiskey casks. Several more were bound in a neatly corrugated cascade down his back, which made him look like some exotic form of caterpillar, balanced precariously upright in mid-pupation. It was a chilly day, but he was sweating freely from the long walk uphill, and cursing in similar vein.
"Why in the name of pride did himself build the frigging house up here in the godforsaken clouds?" he demanded without ceremony. "Why not where a bloody wagon could reach the yard?"
He set the casks down carefully, then ducked his head through the straps of the harness to shed his wooden carapace. He sighed in relief, rubbing at his shoulders where the straps had dug. I ignored the rhetorical question and kept stirring, tilting my head toward the house in invitation.
"There's fresh coffee made," I said, "and bannocks with honey, too."
My own stomach recoiled slightly at the thought of eating. Once spiced, stuffed, boiled, and fried, black pudding was delicious. The earlier stages, involving, as they did, arm-deep manipulations in a barrel of semi-coagulated pig's blood, were substantially less appetizing. Sinclair, though, looked happier at mention of food. He wiped a sleeve across his sweating forehead and nodded to me, turning toward the house. Then he stopped and turned back.
"Ah, I forgot, missus. Have a wee message for yourself as well?"
He patted gingerly at his chest, then lower, probing around his ribs until he at length found what he was looking for and extracted it from the layers of his sweat-soaked clothing. He pulled out a damp wad of paper and held it out to me in expectation, ignoring the fact that my right arm was coated with blood nearly to the shoulder, and the left in scarcely better case.
"Put it in the kitchen, why don't you?" I suggested. "Himself's inside. I'll come as soon as I've got this lot sorted."
"Who?" I started to ask whom the letter was from, but tactfully altered this to,
"Who gave it to you?"
Ronnie couldn't read, though I saw no marks on the outside of the note in any case.
"A tinker on his way to Bellum's Creek handed it to me," he said.
"He didna say who gave it to him, only that it was for the healer."
He frowned at the wadded paper, but I saw his eyes slide sideways toward my legs. In spite of the chill, I was barefoot and stripped to my chemise and stays, no more than a smeared apron wrapped around my waist. Ronnie had been looking for a wife for some little time, and in consequence had formed the unconscious habit of appraising the physical attributes of every woman he encountered, without regard to age or availability. He noticed my noticing, and hastily jerked his gaze away.
"That was all?" I asked. "The healer? He didn't give my name?"
Sinclair rubbed a hand through thinning ginger hair, so two spikes stood up over his reddened ears, increasing his naturally sly, foxy look.
"Didn't have to, did he?"
Without further attempts at conversation, he disappeared into the house in search of food and Jamie, leaving me to my sanguinary labours. The worst part was cleaning the blood, swishing an arm through the dark, reeking depths of the barrel to collect the threads of fibrin that formed as the blood began to clot. These clung to my arm and could then be pulled out and rinsed away, repeatedly. At that, it was slightly less nasty than the job of washing out the intestines to be used for the sausage casings. Brianna and Lizzie were doing that down at the creek. I peered at the latest results, no fibres visible in the clear red liquid that dripped from my fingers. I dunked my arm again in the water cask that stood beside the blood barrel, balanced on boards laid across a pair of trestles under the big chestnut tree. Jamie and Roger and Arch Bug had dragged the pig, not the white sow, but one of her many offspring from a prior year, into the yard, clubbed it between the eyes with a maul, then swung it up into the branches, slit the throat, and let the blood drain into the barrel. Roger and Arch had then taken the disemboweled carcass away to be scalded, and the bristles scraped off. Jamie's presence was required to deal with Major MacDonald, who had appeared suddenly, puffing and wheezing from the climb up to the ridge. Between the two, I thought, Jamie would much have preferred to deal with the pig. I finished washing my hands and arms, wasted labour but necessary to my peace of mind, and dried off with a linen towel. I shovelled double handsful into the barrel from the waiting bowls of barley, oatmeal, and boiled rice, smiling slightly at memory of the Major's plum-red face and Ronnie Sinclair's complaints. Himself had picked his building site on the ridge with a great deal of forethought, precisely because of the difficulties involved in reaching it. I ran my fingers through my hair, then took a deep breath and plunged my clean arm back into the barrel. The blood was cooling rapidly. Doused by the cereal, the smell was less immediate now than the metallic reek of fresh, hot blood. The mixture was still warm to the touch, though, and the grains made graceful swirls of white and brown, pale whirlpools drawn into the blood as I stirred. Ronnie was right. It hadn't been necessary to identify me further than the healer. There wasn't another closer than Cross Creek, unless one counted the shamans among the Indians, which most Europeans wouldn't. I wondered who had sent the note, and whether the matter was urgent. Probably not. At least, it wasn't likely to be a matter of imminent childbirth or serious accident. Word of such events was likely to arrive in person, carried urgently by a friend or relative. A written message entrusted to a tinker couldn't be counted on to be delivered with any sort of promptitude. Tinkers wandered or stayed, depending on what work they found. For that matter, tinkers and tramps seldom came so far as the ridge, though we'd seen three within the last month. I didn't know whether that was the result of our growing population. Fraser's Ridge boasted nearly 60 families now, though the cabins were scattered over 10 miles of forested mountain slopes. Or something more sinister. "It's one of the signs, Sassenach," Jamie had told me, frowning after the departing form of the last such temporary guest. "When there is war in the air, men take to the roads." I thought he was right. I remembered wanderers on the Highland roads carrying rumours of the Stuart Rising. It was as though the tremors of unrest jarred loose those who were not firmly attached to a place by love of land or family, and the swirling currents of dissension bore them onward, the first premonitory fragments of a slow-motion explosion that would shatter everything. I shivered, the light breeze touching cold through my shift. The mass of gruel had reached the necessary consistency, something like a very thick, dark red cream. I shook clumps of clotted grain from my fingers and reached with my clean left hand for the wooden bowl of minced and sautéed onions standing ready. The strong smell of the onions overlaid the scent of butchery, pleasantly domestic. The salt was ground, so was the pepper. All I needed now... As if on cue, Roger appeared around the corner of the house, a large basin in his hands, filled with fine-chopped pork fat. "Just in time," I said, and nodded toward the barrel. "No, don't dump it in.
It has to be measured, roughly. I'd used 10 double hands full of oatmeal, 10 of rice, 10 of barley. Half that total, then. 15. I shook back the hair from my eyes again and carefully scooped up a double handful of the basin's content, dropping it into the barrel with a splat. All right, are you? I asked. I gestured toward a stool with my chin, beginning to work the fat into the mixture with my fingers. Roger was still a trifle pale and tight around the mouth, but he gave me a wry smile as he sat.
Fine.
You didn't have to do it, you know.
Yes, I did.
The note of wryness in his voice deepened.
I only wish I'd done it better.
I shrugged, one-shouldered, and reached into the basin he held out for me. It takes practice. Roger had volunteered to kill the pig. Jamie had simply handed him the maul and stood back. I'd seen Jamie kill pigs before. He said a brief prayer, blessed the pig, then crushed the skull with one tremendous blow. It had taken Roger 5 tries, and the memory of the squealing raised goose flesh on my shoulders even now. Afterward, he had set down the maul, gone behind a tree, and been violently sick. I scooped another handful. The mix was thickening, developing a greasy feel. He should have shown you how.
I shouldn't think there's anything technically difficult about it, Roger said dryly.
Straightforward enough, after all, to bash an animal on the head.
Physically, perhaps, I agreed. I scooped more fat, working with both hands now. There's a prayer for it, you know. For slaughtering an animal, I mean. Jamie should have told you. He looked faintly startled.
No, I didn't know.
He smiled, a little better now.
Last rites for the pig, eh?
I don't think it's for the pig's benefit, I said tartly.
We lapsed into silence for a few moments as I creamed the rest of the fat into the grain mixture, pausing to flick away occasional bits of gristle. I could feel Roger's eyes on the barrel, watching the curious alchemy of cookery, that process of making the transfer of life from one being to another palatable. Highland drovers sometimes drain a cup or two of blood from one of their beasts and mix it with oatmeal to eat on the road, I said. Nutritious, I suppose, but less tasty.
Roger nodded, abstracted. He had set down the nearly empty basin and was cleaning dried blood from under his nails with the point of his dirk.
Is it the same as the other one for deer? He asked. The prayer. I've seen Jamie say that one, though I didn't catch all of the words.
The Graloch prayer?
I don't know.
Why don't you ask him? Roger worked industriously on a thumbnail, eyes fixed on his hand.
I wasn't sure if he thought it right for me to know it. Me not being Catholic, I mean.
I looked down into the mixture, hiding a smile. I don't think it would make a difference. That particular prayer is a lot older than the Church of Rome, if I'm not mistaken. A flicker of interest lit Roger's face, the buried scholar coming to the surface.
I did think the Gaelic was a very old form, even older than what you hear these days, I mean, now.
He flushed a little, realizing what he had said. I nodded, but didn't say anything. I remembered what it was like, that feeling that one was living in an elaborate make-believe. The feeling that reality existed in another time, another place. I remembered, and with a small shock realized that it was now only a memory. For me, time had shifted, as though my illness had pushed me through some final barrier. Now was my time. Reality, the scrape of wood and slick of grease beneath my fingers. The arc of the sun that set the rhythm of my days. The nearness of Jamie. It was the other world, of cars and ringing telephones, of alarm clocks and mortgages, that seemed unreal and remote. The stuff of dreams. Neither Roger nor Bree had made that transition, though. I could see it in the way they behaved, hear it in the echoes of their private conversations. Likely it was because they had each other. They could keep the other time alive. A small, shared world between them. For me, the change was easier. I had lived here before,
had come this time on purpose, after all. And I had Jamie. No matter what I told him of the future, he could never see it as other than a fairy tale. Our small, shared world was built of different things. I worried now and then about Bree and Roger, though. It was dangerous to treat the past, as they sometimes did, as picturesque or curious, a temporary condition that could be escaped. There was no escape for them, whether it was love or duty. Jemmy held them both, a small red-headed anchor to the present. Better, or safer at least, if they could wholly accept this time as theirs. "The Indians have it too," I said to Roger. "The Gralloch prayer, or something like it. That's why I said I thought it older than the church." He nodded, interested.
"I think that kind of thing is common to all primitive cultures. Any place where men kill to eat."
Primitive cultures. I caught my lower lip between my teeth, forbearing to point out that, primitive or not, if his family were to survive, he personally would very likely be obliged to kill for them. But then I caught sight of his hand, idly rubbing at the dried blood between his fingers. He knew that already.
"Yes, I did," he'd said, when I told him he need not.
He looked up then, caught my eye, and gave me a faint, tired smile. He understood.
"I think maybe it's that killing without ceremony seems like murder," he said slowly. "If you have the ceremony, some sort of ritual that acknowledges your necessity." "Necessity, and also sacrifice."
Jamie's voice came softly from behind me, startling me. I turned my head sharply. He was standing in the shadow of the big red spruce.
I wondered how long he'd been there.
"Didn't hear you come out," I said, turning up my face to be kissed as he came to me. "Has the Major gone?"
"No,"
he said, and kissed my brow, one of the few clean spots left.
"I've left him with Sinclair for a bit. He's exercised about the Committee of Safety, aye?"
He grimaced, then turned to Roger.
"Aye, you've the right of it," he said. "Killing's never a pleasant business, but it's needful. If you must spill blood, though, it's right to take it with thanks."
Roger nodded, glancing at the mixture I was working, up to my elbows in spilled blood.
"He'll tell me the proper words for the next time, then."
"Not too late for this time, is it?" I said. Both men looked slightly startled. I raised an eyebrow at Jamie, then Roger. "I did say it wasn't for the pig." Jamie's eyes met mine with a glint of humour, but he nodded gravely.
"Well enough."
At my direction, he took up the heavy jar of spices, the ground mixture of mace and marjoram, sage and pepper, parsley and thyme. Roger held out his hands, cupped, and Jamie poured them full. Then Roger rubbed the herbs slowly between his palms, showering the dusty greenish crumbs into the barrel, their pungent scent mingling with the smell of the blood. As Jamie spoke the words slowly, in an ancient tongue come down from the days of the Norsemen.
"Say it in English," I said, seeing from Roger's face that while he spoke the words, he didn't recognize them all.
"O Lord, bless the blood and the flesh of this the creature that you gave me,"
Jamie said softly. He scooped a pinch of the herbs himself and rubbed them between thumb and forefinger in a rain of fragrant dust.
"Created by your hand as you created man, life given for life, that me and mine may eat with thanks for the gift, that me and mine may give thanks for your own sacrifice of blood and flesh. Life given for life."
The last crumbs of green and grey disappeared into the mixture under my hands, and the ritual of the sausage was complete.
"That was good of you, Sassenach,"
Jamie said, drying my clean wet hands and arms with a towel afterward. He nodded toward the corner of the house, where Roger had disappeared to help with the rest of the butchering, looking somewhat more peaceful.
I did think to tell him before, but I couldn't see how to do it.
I smiled and moved close to him. It was a cold, windy day, and now that I had stopped working, the chill drove me closer to seek his warmth. He wrapped his arms around me, and I felt both the reassuring heat of his embrace and the soft crackle of paper inside his shirt. "What's that?"
"Oh, a bitty letter Sinclair's brought,"
he said, drawing back a bit to reach into his shirt.
"I didn't want to open it while Donald was there, and didn't trust him not to be reading it when I went out."
"It's not your letter anyway," I said, taking the smudged wad of paper from him. "It's mine."
"Oh, is it? Sinclair didn't say, just handed it to me."
"He would." Not unusually, Ronnie Sinclair viewed me, all women for that matter, as simply a minor appendage of a husband. I rather pitied the woman he might eventually induce to marry him. I unfolded the note with some difficulty. It had been worn so long next to sweaty skin that the edges had frayed and stuck together. The message inside was brief and cryptic, but unsettling. It had been scratched into the paper with something like a sharpened stick, using an ink that looked disturbingly like dried blood, though it was more likely berry juice.
"What does it say, Sassenach?"
Seeing me frowning at the paper, Jamie moved to the side to look. I held it out to him. Far down, in one corner, scratched in faint and tiny letters, as though the sender had hoped by this means to escape notice, was the word Phaedri. Above, in bolder scratchings, the message read, "You come." "It must be her," I said, shivering as I drew my shawl closer. It was cold in the surgery, despite the small brazier glowing in the corner. But Ronnie Sinclair and MacDonald were in the kitchen, drinking cider and waiting while the sausages boiled. I spread the note open on my surgery table, its minatory summons dark and peremptory above the timid signature. "Look, who else could it be?"
"She cannot write, surely," Jamie objected. "Though I suppose it might be that someone wrote it for her," he amended, frowning.
"No, she could have written this, I think." Priyana and Roger had come into the surgery, too. Bree reached out and touched the ragged paper, one long finger gently tracing the staggered letters. "I taught her."
"You did?"
Jamie looked surprised.
"When?"
"When I stayed at River Run, when you and Mama went to find Roger." Her wide mouth pressed thin for a moment. It wasn't an occasion she wished much to remember. "I taught her the alphabet. I meant to teach her to read and write. We did all the letters. She knew how they sounded, and she could draw them. But then, one day, she said she couldn't any more, and she wouldn't sit down with me." She glanced up, a troubled frown between her thick red brows. "I thought maybe Aunt Jocasta found out and stopped her."
"More likely Ulysses. Jocasta would have stopped you, lass."
Jamie's frown matched hers as he glanced at me.
"You do think it's Phaedra, then? My aunt's body slave?"
I shook my head and bit one corner of my lip in doubt. "The slaves at River Run do say her name like that, Phaedri, and I certainly don't know anyone else by that name." Jamie had questioned Ronnie Sinclair casually, to give no occasion for alarm or gossip, but the cooper knew no more than he had told me. The note had been handed to him by a tinker, with the simple direction that it was for the healer. I leaned over the table, lifting a candle high to look at the note once more. The F of the signature had been made with a hesitant, repeated stroke, more than one try before the writer had committed herself to signing it. The more evidence, I thought, of its origin. I didn't know whether it was against the law in North Carolina to teach a slave to read or write, but it was certainly discouraged. While there were marked exceptions, slaves educated to their owners' ends, like Ulysses himself, it was, on the whole, a dangerous skill, and one a slave would go some way to conceal.
She wouldn't have risked sending word like this, unless it was a serious matter,
Roger said. He stood behind Bree, one hand on her shoulder, looking down at the note she held flattened on the table.
But what?
Have you heard from your aunt lately? I asked Jamie. But I knew the answer before he shook his head. Any word from River Run that reached the ridge would have been a matter of public knowledge within hours. We hadn't gone to the gathering at Mount Helicon this year. There was too much to do on the ridge, and Jamie wished to avoid the heated politics involved. Still, Jocasta and Duncan had meant to be there. Anything wrong would surely have been a matter of general gossip, which would have reached us long since.
"So it's not only serious, but a private matter to the slave, too," Jamie said. "Otherwise my aunt would have written, or Duncan sent word."
His two stiff fingers tapped once, softly, against his thigh. We stood around the table, staring at the note as though it were a small white slab of dynamite. The scent of boiling sausages filled the cold air, warm and comforting.
"Why, you?" Roger asked, looking up at me. "Do you think it might be a medical matter? If she were ill, say, or pregnant?"
"Not illness," I said. "Too urgent." It was a week's ride to River Run, at least, in good weather, and barring accident. Heaven knew how long it had taken the note to make its way up to Fraser's Ridge. "But if she was pregnant, maybe." Brianna pursed her lips, still frowning at the paper. "I think she thinks of Mama as a friend. She'd tell you before she'd tell Aunt Jocasta, I think." I nodded, but reluctantly. Friendship was too strong a word. People situated as Federer and I couldn't be friends. Liking was constrained by too many things. Suspicion, mistrust, the vast chasm of difference that slavery imposed. And yet there was a certain feeling of sympathy between us. That much was true. I had worked with her, side by side, planting herbs and harvesting them, making simples for the stillroom, explaining their uses. We had buried a dead girl together, and plotted to protect a runaway slave accused of her murder. She had a certain talent with the sick, did Fedre, and some knowledge of herbs. Any minor matter she could deal with herself, but something like an unexpected pregnancy. What does she think I could do, though, I wonder? I was thinking out loud, and my fingertips felt cold in contemplation. An unexpected child born to a slave would be of no concern to an owner. To the contrary, it would be welcomed as additional property. But I had heard stories of slave women who killed a child at birth, rather than have the babe brought up in slavery. Fedra was a house slave, though, well treated, and Jocasta didn't separate slave families. I knew that. If it were that, Fedra's situation was surely not so dire. And yet, who was I to judge? I blew out a cloud of smoky breath, uncertain. I just can't see why. I mean, she couldn't possibly expect that I'd help her to get rid of a child. And for anything else, why me? There are midwives and healers much closer. It just doesn't make sense. What if, Brianna said, and stopped. She pursed her lips in speculation, looking from me to Jamie and back. What if, she said carefully, she was pregnant, but the father was someone it shouldn't be? A wary but humorous speculation sprang up in Jamie's eyes, increasing the resemblance between him and Brianna.
"Who'll ask?" he said. "Farquhar Campbell?"
I laughed out loud at the thought, and Brianna snorted with mirth, white wisps of breath floating round her head. The notion of the very upright and quite elderly Farquhar Campbell seducing a house slave was...
"Well, no," Brianna said. "Though he does have all those children. But I just thought suddenly, what if it was Duncan?"
Jamie cleared his throat and avoided catching my eye. I bit my lip, feeling my face start to go red. Duncan had confessed his chronic impotence to Jamie before Duncan's wedding to Jocasta, but Brianna didn't know.
"Oh, I shouldn't think it likely," Jamie said, sounding a trifle choked.
He coughed and fanned smoke from the brazier away from his face.
"What gives you that notion, lass?"
"Nothing about Duncan," she assured him. "But Aunt Jocasta is, well, old. And you know what men can be like."
"No, what?"
asked Roger blandly, making me cough with the effort to suppress a laugh. Jamie eyed her with a certain amount of cynicism.
"A good deal better than you do, Ian. And while I wouldn't wager much on some men, I think I should feel safe in laying odds that Duncan Innes isn't the man to be breaking his marriage vows with his wife's black slave."
I made a small noise, and Roger lifted one eyebrow at me.
"Are you all right?"
"Fine," I said, sounding strangled. "Just fine." I put a corner of the shawl over my no-doubt purple face and coughed ostentatiously. "It's smoky in here, isn't it?" "Maybe so," Brianna conceded, addressing Jamie. "It might not be that at all. It's just that Phaedra sent the note to the healer, probably because she didn't want to use Mama's name in case anyone saw the note before it got here. I just thought maybe it wasn't really Mama she wants. Maybe it's you." That sobered both Jamie and me, and we glanced at each other. It was a definite possibility, and one that hadn't occurred to either of us. "She couldn't send a note direct to you without rousing all kinds of curiosity," Bree went on, frowning at the note. "But she could say, the healer, without putting a name on it. And she'd know that if Mama came, you'd probably come with her at this time of year. Or if you didn't, Mama could send for you openly."
"That's a thought," Jamie said slowly. "But why in God's name might she want me?" "Only one way to find out," said Roger, practical. He looked at Jamie. "Most of the outside work is done. The crops and the hay are in. The slaughtering's finished. We can manage here if you want to go."
Jamie stood still for a moment, frowning in thought, then crossed to the window and raised the sash. A cold wind blew into the room, and Bree pinned the fluttering note to the table to keep it from taking wing. The coals in the small brazier smoked and flamed higher, and the bunches of dried herbs rustled uneasily overhead. Jamie thrust his head out the window and breathed in deeply, eyes closed like one savouring the bouquet of fine wine.
"Cold and clear," he announced, drawing in his head and closing the window. "Clear weather for 3 days at least. We could be off the mountain by that time, and we ride briskly."
He smiled at me. The tip of his nose was red with the cold.
"In the meantime, do you think those sausages are ready yet?"
Chapter 72 Betrayals. A slave I didn't recognize opened the door to us, a broad-built woman in a yellow turban. She eyed us severely, but Jamie gave her no chance to speak, pushing rudely past her into the hall. "He's Mrs. Cameron's nephew," I felt obliged to explain to her as I followed him.
"I can see that," she muttered,
in a lilt that came from Barbados. She glared after him, making it evident that she detected a family resemblance in terms of high-handedness, as well as physique. "I'm his wife," I added, overcoming the reflexive urge to shake her hand and bowing slightly instead. "Claire Fraser. Nice to meet you." She blinked, disconcerted, but before she could reply, I had whisked past her, following Jamie toward the small drawing-room where Jocasta was inclined to sit in the afternoons. The door to the drawing-room was closed, and as Jamie set his hand on the knob, a sharp yelp came from inside, the prelude to a barrage of frenzied barking as the door swung wide. Stopped in his tracks, Jamie paused, hand on the door, frowning at the small brown bundle of fur that leapt to and fro at his feet, eyes bulging in hysteria as it barked its head off.
"What is that?" he said, edging his way into the room as the creature made abortive dashes at his boots, still yapping.
"It's a wee dog. What do you think?"
Jocasta said acerbically. She lifted herself from her chair, frowning in the direction of the noise.
"Haas, Samson."
"Samson? Oh, to be sure, the hare."
Smiling despite himself, Jamie squatted and extended a closed fist toward the dog. Throttling back to a low growl, the dog extended a suspicious nose toward his knuckles.
"Where's Delilah?" I asked, edging into the room behind him.
"Ah, you've come as well, Claire."
Jocasta's face swiveled in my direction, lit by a smile.
"A rare treat to have the both of you. I didn't suppose Brianna or the bitty lad have come along." "No, I would have heard them."
Dismissing that, she sat down again and waved towards the hearth.
"As for Delilah, the lazy creature's asleep by the fire. I can hear her snoring."
Delilah was a large whitish hound of indeterminate breed, but plentiful skin. It drooped around her in folds of relaxation as she lay on her back, paws curled over a freckled belly. Hearing her name, she snorted briefly, opened one eye a crack, then closed it again.
"I see you've had a few changes since I was last here," Jamie observed, rising to his feet. "Where is Duncan and Ulysses?"
"Gone. Looking for Phaedra."
Jocasta had lost weight. The high Mackenzie cheekbones stood out sharp, and her skin looked thin and creased.
"Looking for her?"
Jamie glanced sharply at her.
"What's become of the lass?"
"Run away."
She spoke with her usual self-possession, but her voice was bleak.
"Run away? But
are you sure?"
Her workbox had been upset, the contents spilled on the floor. I knelt and began to tidy the confusion, picking up the scattered reels of thread.
"Well, she's gone," Jocasta said with some acerbity. "Either she's run or someone's stolen her. And I cannot think who would have the gall or the skill to snatch her from my house, and no one seeing."
I exchanged a quick glance with Jamie, who shook his head, frowning. Jocasta was rubbing a fold of her skirt between thumb and forefinger. I could see small worn spots in the nap of the fabric near her hand, where she had done it repeatedly. Jamie saw it too.
"When did she go, Auntie?"
he asked quietly.
4 weeks passed. Duncan and Ulysses have been gone for 2.
That fitted well enough with the arrival of the note. No telling how long before her disappearance the note had actually been written, given the vagaries of delivery.
"I see Duncan took pains to leave you some company," Jamie observed.
Samson had abandoned his watchdog role and was sniffing assiduously at Jamie's boots. Delilah rolled onto her side with a luxurious groan and opened 2 luminous brown eyes, through which she regarded me with utmost tranquillity.
"Why? They're that."
Half-grudgingly, Jocasta leaned out from her chair and located the hound's head, scratching behind the long, floppy ears.
"Though Duncan meant them for my protection, or so he said."
"A sensible precaution,"
Jamie said mildly. It was. We had had no further word of Stephen Bonnet, nor had Jocasta heard the voice of the masked man again. But lacking the concrete reassurance of a corpse, either one could presumably pop up at any time.
"Why would the lassie run, aunt?" Jamie asked.
His tone was still mild but persistent. Jocasta shook her head, lips compressed.
"I dunna ken at all, nephew."
"Nothing's happened of late. Nothing out of the ordinary," he pressed.
"Do you not think I should have said at once?" she asked sharply. "No. I woke late one morning and couldn't hear her about my room. There was nae tea by my bed, and the fire had gone out. I could smell the ashes. I called for her, and there was no answer. Gone she was, vanished without a trace."
She tilted her head toward him with a grim sort of "so there" expression. I raised a brow at Jamie and touched the pocket I wore at my waist, containing the note. "Ought we to tell her?" He nodded,
and I drew the note from my pocket, unfolding it on the arm of her chair as he explained. Jocasta's look of displeasure faded into one of puzzled astonishment. "Why ever would she send for you, Aeneian?" she asked, turning to me. "I don't know. Perhaps she was with child," I suggested, "or had contracted a disease of some sort." I didn't want to suggest syphilis openly, but it was a possibility. If Manfred had infected Mrs. Sylvie, and she had then passed the infection on to one or more of her customers in Cross Creek, who then had visited River Run. But that would mean, perhaps, that Phaedra had had some kind of relationship with a white man. That was something a slave woman would go to great lengths to keep secret. Jocasta, no fool, was rapidly coming to similar conclusions, though her thoughts ran parallel to mine. "A child, that would be no great matter," she said, flicking a hand. "But if she had a lover..." "Aye," she said thoughtfully, "she might have gone off with a lover. But then, why send for you?" Jamie was growing restive, impatient with so much unprovable speculation.
"Perhaps she might think you meant to sell her, aunt, if you discovered such a thing."
"To sell her?"
Jocasta broke out laughing. Not her usual social laughter, not even the sound of genuine amusement. This was shocking, loud and crude, almost vicious in its hilarity. It was her brother Dougal's laugh, and the blood ran momentarily cold in my veins. I glanced at Jamie, to find him looking down at her, face gone blank. Not in puzzlement. It was the mask he wore to hide strong feeling, so he'd heard that grisly echo too. She seemed unable to stop. Her hands clutched the curved arms of her chair, and she leaned forward, face turning red, gasping for breath between those unnerving deep guffaws. Delilah rolled onto her belly and uttered a low woof of unease, looking anxiously round, unsure what the matter was, but convinced that something wasn't right. Samson had backed under the settee, growling. Jamie reached out and took her by the shoulder, not gently.
"Be still, aunt," he said. "You're frightening your wee dogs."
She stopped, abruptly. There was no sound but the faint wheeze of her breathing, nearly as unnerving as the laughter. She sat still, bolt upright in her chair, hands on the arms, the blood ebbing slowly from her face, and her eyes gone dark and bright, fixed as though on something that only she could see.
"Sell her," she murmured,
and her mouth creased as though the laughter were about to break out of her again. She didn't laugh, though, but stood up suddenly. Samson yapped once in astonishment.
"Come with me."
She was through the door before either of us could say anything. Jamie lifted an eyebrow at me, but motioned me through the door before him. She knew the house intimately. She made her way down the hall toward the door to the stables, with no more than an occasional touch of the wall to keep her bearings, walking as fast as though she could see. Outside, though, she paused, feeling with one extended foot for the edge of the brick-laid path. Jamie stepped up beside her and took her firmly by the elbow.
"Where do you wish to go?"
he asked, a certain resignation in his tone.
"To the carriage barn."
The peculiar laughter had left her, but her face was still flushed, her strong chin lifted with an air of defiance. Who was she defying, I wondered. The carriage barn was shadowed and tranquil, dust motes drifting gold in the stir of air from the open doors. A wagon, a carriage, a sledge, and the elegant two-wheeled trap sat like large, placid beasts on the straw-covered floor. I glanced at Jamie, whose mouth curled slightly as he looked at me. We had taken temporary refuge in the carriage during the chaos of Jocasta's wedding to Duncan, almost 4 years before. Jocasta paused in the doorway, one hand braced on the jamb, and breathing deeply, as though orienting herself. She made no move to enter the barn herself, though, but instead nodded toward the depths of the building.
along the back wall, Anwick Mahaihar. There are boxes there. I want the large chest made of wickerwork, the one as high as your knee, with a rope tied round it.
I hadn't really noticed during our earlier excursion into the carriage barn, but the back wall was stacked high with boxes, crates and bundles, piled 2 and 3 deep. With such explicit direction, though, Jamie made short work of finding the desired container and dragged it out into the light, covered with dust and bits of straw.
"Shall I carry it into the house for you, Auntie?" he asked, rubbing a finger under a twitching nose.
She shook her head, stooping and feeling for the knot of the rope that bound it.
"No, I shall not have it the house. I swore I should not."
"Let me." I laid a hand on hers to still her fumbling, then took charge of the knot myself. Whoever had tied